Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. The Coffee Clatch and Special Needs Talk Radio Network feature outstanding programming for the special needs community. Our team of hosts provide educational interviews. Our shows are not designed to provide listeners with specific or personal medical, legal, or professional service or advice. Parents of children with health issues should always consult their health care provider for medical advice, medications, or treatment. Any show discussing rights and law for special needs children in special education are presented as general information and not legal advice. Special Needs Coffee Clatch Limited does not promote any host or guest's individual practice, programs, treatments, or products. We thank you for joining us and are proud to provide excellence in broadcasting for the special needs community. And now, on to the interview.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Richard Selznick, and I want to welcome you to this newest edition of School Struggles. I am proud to be a part of the Coffee Clatch team. And on School Struggles, we talk about a range of topics, including learning disabilities, dyslexia, special education, ADHD, and a whole host of other interesting topics that affect your child. I am a child psychologist and the director of the Cooper Learning Center, which is a part of the Department of Pediatrics, Cooper University Healthcare, located in Voorhees, New Jersey, which is outside of the Philadelphia area. We're in South Jersey. I am the author of The Shutdown Learner, Helping Your Academically Discouraged Child, another book called School Struggles, and my more recent publication, Dyslexia Screening, Essential Concepts for Schools and Parents. These are all available on Amazon or Barnes & Nobles, and you can learn about the books and my stuff at www.shutdownlearner.com. That site is loaded with blogs and lots of great information for parents, and you can follow me on Twitter by following at Dr. Sells, that's D-R-S-E-L-Z, and on Facebook under Shutdown Learner. You may also want to go to thecoffeeclatch.com. It's one word, the Coffee Clatch. So tonight we are talking with Jessica Zarotny. I'm getting my decoding skills in line here by pronouncing your name, Jessica. Did I do a good job?
Yes, you did a great job, Dr. Sells.
Oh, good. And Jessica is the lead occupational therapist at Sensational Kids, a wonderful group in Marlton, New Jersey. Jessica got her master's degree in occupational therapy at Philadelphia University, graduating in 2012, and she's very passionate about her work and about new research in the field. She really tries to stay up to date, and as she noted in her bio, she's very much a kid at heart, and her clinical and professional experience, as well as her knowledge of child development and behavioral analysis, sensory integration, really helps kids in many, many ways. So, Jessica, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Excited to have you on. By way of introduction as well, I was reflecting on the fact that, you know, in this field, there's a dizzying array of professional players out there, you know, anywhere from neurologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, occupational therapists, speech and language, the list goes on and on. And I think it's sometimes difficult to know, you know, what direction to go as a parent. So tonight we're going to be discussing, you know, what does occupational therapy, otherwise known as OT, what does OT bring to the table, and what's their part in working? We're going to primarily talk tonight about learning disabilities, ADHD, dyslexia, some behavior. That's kind of mostly our focus. So, Jess, tell us about an OT. What's the primary role of a pediatric occupational therapist?
Well, I think that a pediatric occupational therapist is definitely a unique role. So if you know what occupational therapy is in general, I think oftentimes you think of it in a grander scale and you think of it with adults. So in regard to pediatrics and the kiddos that I work with, I'm focusing mostly on their occupations. So occupations for a kiddo are play, academics and learning, and social participation. So my scope of practice is very, very wide. It's a wide range. But my primary focus in this setting, in an outpatient setting, is sensory processing, sensory integration. So working on their sensory systems, their fine motor skill development, their visual motor skill development, and then really just overall social and emotional regulation. So just getting them more functionally independent in their day-to-day routines, whatever is impacting that specific kiddo.
You know, I'm going to play the naive parent here.
Okay.
So I'm going to play the role of naive parent. So tell me, back me up again. When you spoke at the beginning about, you know, occupational therapy in adults, I don't really know what that means. So tell me what that means first, and then we'll shift into how you see it more so with the kids.
Absolutely. So with occupational therapy working with adults, you're going to focus more on their occupations, which are more well-defined. So if
like a real concrete example.
Absolutely. So if an adult has, say, a stroke and they lose unilateral control, so say they lose control or strength in their right side of their body, they need to get back to work. They work in an office setting. They need to be able to type and have that coordination back. The therapist's job is to get them more functionally independent so they can get back to work, get their strength back, get their coordination back, their sensation, and get them essentially back to doing their day-to-day activities from their job title, being a mother, being a father, being a person that likes to be active in, you know, the community. So getting them functionally independent to get back to what they enjoy doing every day.
So occupational therapy will target, effectively keep in the back of the therapist's mind the actual occupation. So if you're a carpenter, for example, keep the occupation in mind as to how do I get that person more back into his skill set so that he or she can be doing that type of work that they do. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. So that's really easy to define for it. Well, a lot more easy to define as an adult when working
right,
with
right, because you know it's, right, that's right. Because you don't have, as an adult, using the carpenter example, it's like okay, there's a defined set of skills I would presume that one needs to have in order to carry out that occupation. Then if your fine motor skills are off of, you know, dexterity, things like that, you need to have those worked on or targeted. So whereas a child, their broader skill sets that they need to bring to the table. So, and I think that that's what you're alluding to.
Absolutely, yes.
So how does occupational therapy then differ from, and even starting with the adults and then shifting into the kids, how does occupational therapy differ from something like physical therapy?
So occupational therapy, I always, whenever I talk to people and people ask me what I do, I say I'm an occupational therapist, and they either give me a kind of a look, like they know what I'm saying, or they, you know, they pretty much let me know that they have no idea what that means. So
right.
My definition is always in comparison to physical therapy because it's a pretty easy and quick definition. So I typically say that physical therapy is going to work more on strengthening gross motor skills and just overall strength for the lower body, and the occupational therapist role is more strengthening the fine motor skills and then the upper body, as well as the cognitive piece, so strengthening the brain, essentially.
Many of the kids that get referred to occupational therapy that I see, and it's related primarily to writing deficits, and what I would like you to walk us through. One would be, you know, there's always this question about dysgraphia and what that is and how you test for it. Now, do you guys do testing as part of an occupational therapist for something like dysgraphia?
Absolutely. With dysgraphia.
How is that done?
Yeah, with dysgraphia, that's definitely one of the more challenging diagnoses, especially because it's pretty undefined. It's not very clear cut. There are a lot of things that can impact that. So, in very basic terms,
what is dysgraphia?
Dysgraphia is basically the inability to put thoughts or actions on paper. So maybe a child has the thought process to carry out and create this beautiful story, but when that translates to paper, their handwriting is off, their legibility is off, their spacing, being able to kind of really clearly see what they're trying to put on paper becomes challenging. So it's kind of a disconnect between the brain and the hand. And then
now,
the vision.
Find most of those kids, and this is where I get myself confused in this world too, because so many of the kids that I evaluate for, say, reading disability or dyslexia, those kids also invariably have writing problems. You know, I had one this morning that I evaluated. She has sentence structure issues, spelling issues. Her penmanship was pretty good. Her handwriting wasn't bad. So I didn't see that so much as dysgraphia as something linked to the whole reading disability and learning disability, you know?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's sometimes hard to tease out what's what with these things. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, I definitely agree.
And you don't have
that.
To agree with me. It's already okay not to agree. It's really okay.
I'm going to agree in this, but I won't always agree.
You know. So how do you test for it on your side?
On my side, there's probably 15 to 20 standardized assessments I can choose from. So what I like to do is I like to start with a parent interview, kind of get a general idea of what the main struggles are going to be, and then I always, from there, do just a quick writing sample to see where they're at. And then I can usually pull from there, and I just...
I'm sorry to interrupt. The writing, because I do something like that as well, I want to make sure we're on the same page that way. So the writing sample could be something like, describe your weekend or anything like that. It's an informal kind of paragraph, that type of thing?
Yes, absolutely. And then if they're younger, I'll give them something to copy. So if I know that they don't have the skill set or the cognition to create something out of thin air, then I'll just give them a quick, my favorite sentence is, the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. You know what's so interesting about that sentence, Dr. Selznick?
Oh, I have no idea, so go right ahead.
It has every letter in the alphabet, so you're going to
I think I knew that at one time in my life, but I've forgotten that. But so that's right. That's how you practice typing.
Yes, it's a fantastic trick. So that's a good go-to
for me. I should practice that. I need to practice that. Okay. good. Okay.
So, yeah, and then I'd pick, depending on what I see from that sample, I'm going to pick a more specific standardized test, whether it's just the etch, which that's just going to look at specifically at handwriting, at their letter formation, the sequencing of the way that they're creating their letters, or I'll just do a fine motor coordination assessment, such as like the Peabody or the BOT. These are just names of assessments. These are kind of my go-tos.
Those are your favorite tests. Okay. So then from that point, assuming the kid has some issues and they're coming out a bit below average with some of the major tests that you gave, you develop some kind of treatment plan. Why don't you walk us through a typical, I don't know, you want to take a six-year-old kid? You want to do that, or what age do you want to pick?
Let's go six.
Six-year-old first grader who's, been having trouble. He's learning. He knows his I'm making this up as we go. He knows his letters some in terms of identifying them. He knows a few sight words, a very, very early stage reading child. So he comes into your office, and you now meet him and worked with him, and you found some issues. So then walk us through what you might do with him.
Well, I'm going to see. I want to – with a kiddo that is – 6 years old, they've gotten pretty far along. So they've gotten through kindergarten and they're entering first grade, and obviously their parents have decided that they're ready for that, but that maybe they might be a little bit behind. So what I'm going to do first is I'll probably try to rule out any sensory processing difficulties that may be bogging them down or maybe limiting their independence with use of helper hand or just that midline of their body. So the midline of a child's body is something very kind of it's an obvious thing to diagnose if a child just really doesn't have awareness between the right and left side of their body. This is a kiddo who a kiddo who probably didn't have a dominant hand right away, or was maybe at that point is still switching between right and left, and it's just not dominant in one side. So I will focus on bigger movements and bigger skills with the bilateral coordination to pull those two, to pull right brain and left brain together a little bit more. And then I'm going to focus on specific writing goals. So sustained attention for writing, increasing the span of time that a child can attend, if that's something that's limiting them, or just speed of writing, so copying skills. And then getting to the bare bones of the praxis and the ability to motor plan those letters and those words in the correct order, because there's, if a child's putting a letter on or a word on paper, but they're sequencing it from bottom to top, or say they're, you know, going from right to left, they're going to be way behind in their speed. So I'm going to focus on the little skills that all go into the bigger picture of writing and reading.
So what I'm getting out of this, again, I'm trying to put myself in the role of, you know, not trying to be, you know, a psychologist as much as a parent who's truly trying to understand. So what I'm hearing you say is that children are often either at a certain stage of their lives, I'm using the term confused, you didn't say that, but left-right confusion, they haven't established dominance of hand, so they might switch pen from left hand to right hand, or they might start at the wrong side of the page. You know, they may not have the instinct or the intuitive understanding to start on the left side when they're working in writing or written, or putting down the alphabet. Are all of those things kind of, as you know, am I correct in what I've said in terms of my interpretation?
Absolutely. It is partly instinctive, but it's more just a lack of awareness, in my opinion.
Lack of awareness.
So
I think that's very
awareness.
True, and I think that's very true. I just want to punctuate that for anybody listening, that I think I see that with little, young kids, that there's kind of a lack of an awareness when it comes to some of these issues. Like, I use a test called the Bender Gestalt, which basically it's like the Beery in some ways, you know, the developmental test of visual motor integration. And, you know, you see where the child positions the design on the page, and if they are somewhat aware of space, so to speak, they're starting at the top left corner and they're working their way down in a somewhat ordered way. If they seem to have a lack of an awareness, then they could be all over the place. It's kind of random.
Yes.
In their style.
Yes. And then pulling those, when you can add those skills in and you add that coordination piece in, mm-hmm. all of that kind of just comes together for a kiddo. So if you can just refine the little underlying skills that an OT would be responsible for refining, such as just dexterity, strength, even just body awareness. Some kids just need a little bit more awareness of the midline of their body and their body's roles. Then you'll see such a huge change, and pretty quickly, I would say.
I really like what you guys do for children in terms of this kind of work. I wrote a little bit of a provocative essay, a blog a while back, saying, you know, that the writing process goes beyond OT. What I'm hearing is that you're working at a certain level of development in terms of written expression. But I think what parents need to understand, from my perspective, is I think that OT does great work at the first stage of writing development, like the very rock bottom level of skill work and skill focus, and that there's another stage that OT doesn't necessarily go to. What's your commentary on that?
Absolutely. I think there's what I often see is fast gains. I see great improvements in maybe one piece of this. But then if I find that I'm plateauing, and then there's often kind of a missing piece. Like, and that's when, you know, say a teacher is the one that referred to me. So I've gotten, or maybe even a pediatrician. Pediatrician or a teacher refers to me. We tackle this fine motor piece. We get to a great point. And then at that point, I'm seeing maybe some more of the visual motor piece kind of falling apart, or we're just not getting past where we are. Then I need to call it a Dr. Selznick, or, you know, I need to get that some additional testing done to see if there's something that I've missed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that writing, written expression is just so incredibly complicated that so many of the kids that I deal with have fundamental writing problems. And I think that so much of it is tied into after you've taken care of some of the fine motor, well, then they still have spelling errors, and they still have word choice errors, and they still have, you know, semantic and syntactic kind of confusion that mm-hmm. is now beyond the work of OT. But a good writing remedial writing specialist, or, you know, someone who knows like an Orton Gillingham type of style process for writing seems to me to be the next phase of that, you know. Tell us, okay, so the kids really enjoy the work. I mean, I've been in your center, and it looks like a lot of fun in terms of the equipment, and so the kids tend to like this type of therapy?
Yes, it's an easy therapy to make fun, as long as you have to remember kids love novelty, and they love, you know, just the newness of something, tailoring it to their needs, or their needs, and then their likes, their interests. I mean, I'm wearing a Star Wars R2-D2 scrub top right now, not because I love Star Wars, but because I know that my kids today will be motivated by that. You have to
keep it fun.
See, I'm not. And keep
I'm
it
not
light.
Wearing that. Yeah, I'm not wearing that. I need to. I'm going to put on something. How long is a typical session? A half hour?
For fine motor, it depends on the severity. Majority of my kids I see for 60 minutes. But if it's just fine motor and I know that kiddo has a great attention span and they're motivated towards what I'm going to do, we can make that happen in 30. But I would say ideally 60 minutes is how long I typically treat.
Are occupational therapy sessions often covered by insurance?
Yes, they are, especially if it is a fine motor delay that's impacting, their progress and their success in school. Now, if it's out, you know, if that child is going to come to me first, I'm going to obviously recommend that they do a school occupational therapy evaluation too, so they can get services right in that school setting. And then a child would maybe choose, or a family would choose, to have that kiddo come separately here just to refine that and to speed up the process of that, so they're getting a little extra.
And that brings up that question that we have about the role of the difference really between the role of an occupational therapist in a school setting versus one in like your office. What do you see are the fundamental differences between the two?
I would say the biggest thing is the sensory piece. So if anybody's heard of sensory processing disorder, that's something that's not really going to be recognized in a school setting at this time, unfortunately. That's something that I can tackle, and I tackle every day in the outpatient setting, and that really truly impacts all of the other academic-based skills.
I will confess to something right now. I still don't get it. I'm not being a parent right now. I'm being a professional, and I still don't get it. What is sensory processing disorder? I know there's a little bit of controversy in the field, but sometimes there's some professionals that I've heard say, "Oh, that doesn't exist." What is it?
Sensory processing disorder, at the bare bones, is going to. It's so complex, but at the bare bones, it is a disorganization of the sensory systems, and there are some hidden sensory systems. And I'm not going to go jargon on you and give you those terms.
Yeah, because my head won't work. I'll clam up quickly.
There are some hidden sensory systems that are integral to our learning, to our visual processing, to our overall just processing of movement in space. And if those aren't working properly, if they're not organizing themselves the right way, then we're not going to feel very comfortable in just a day-to-day navigation of our environment, success in school, participating socially. There are a lot of things that it impacts.
Would this be a kid, the classic kid who, let's say, we'll go back to a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, that kind of age range, and they are at, I don't know, Chuck E. Cheese or whatever it is out there these days, and they're at a loud birthday party, and there's a lot of stimuli in the air, and most of the kids are having fun, and this one is kind of melting down. Is that, in your mind, an example of likely sensory SPD or sensory processing disorder?
Absolutely. I mean, that's actually a very concrete example. There's auditory stimulation, there's visual stimulation, and it's overwhelming. And
it's overwhelming.
The child's sensory system is not doing its job, and it's not organizing those systems and allowing those systems to help him or she to come, then that's most likely a sensory overload, and that child would benefit from services to organize those systems a bit better.
Now, just to caution people out there, just because your child, I remember my daughter when she was little at the beach felt a little, you know, like she might have been two or something, I don't know, and she was, you know, it was overwhelming to her. Now, there's normal, you know, there are normal reactions to senses and overwhelming senses. It doesn't necessarily mean that a child has a disorder just because they're reacting to loud noises. It's more the trend line of that stuff. That's how I would see it.
Yes, and it has to impact function. So
over time, you have to see it as a kind of like not once in a while. You have to see it, you know, enough.
Right, absolutely. And with you know, with OT, it goes back to function. If a child comes in and their parents are familiar with sensory processing disorder, and maybe they're giving me a few examples, the first question I ask is, do you really think that it's impacting their day to day, or are they getting through? Kids are resilient. They're going to find ways to compensate and get through it. So unless it's really impacting their day to day, then it's not going to be relevant. It's not going to be a sensory processing disorder that needs to be treated.
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. Is it impacting day to day? And I also think that people have to keep development in mind. You know, a 7-year-old boy or a 7-year-old child was never known for writing essays, gang. As much as we think they should be, the little paragraphs were always the norm, if at best. So you have to keep development in mind. And so I think what you're talking about are kids who you take a typical 5-year-old, and these kids that we're talking about are farther out there on the continuum. They're having trouble coping with things that we would consider kind of day-to-day, like a birthday party.
Yes.
Or other social interactions.
Yeah.
Now, what about behavior? You guys also work on behavior. What kinds of behavioral situations do you work with?
Well, oftentimes sensory processing difficulties turn into behaviors. So if a kiddo has a specific sensory processing difficulty, they might be seeking more movement. They might be chewing on their clothing, non-animate objects at kind of past an appropriate age. And those become behaviors because they become socially maybe inappropriate, or at that point they may impact their attention and ability to maintain function in a classroom setting, for example. So an OT's role is to manage behaviors related to those sensory needs and to give, obviously, to fix the sensory processing difficulties that child's having. You know, essentially that means to change the way the brain is processing a specific piece of sensory information, and then give strategies for alternative things to do to self-calm. But we also have behavior therapy here, which is a behavior therapist is going to be more responsible for a grander scale of behavioral intervention. They work a lot with our children who are on the autism spectrum to help just put in place a behavioral plan in the home that's going to help that kiddo be more, be most independent and communicate their needs.
Great. So my chewing on my clothing is not age appropriate then, huh?
Rich, it's not.
But you can work on it. You can help me out.
I can help.
How about you mentioned before, too, another point, picky eating. I know we only have a couple minutes left, but tell us about the picky eating behaviors in your realm.
Picky eating is something I see more and more. So,
yeah.
They
just want to eat nuggets. They only want chicken nuggets.
Chicken nuggets and French fries. Maybe
right, that's
milk.
It.
Yeah. Right.
So what do you do for that?
Well, because I was seeing so much more of this in my facility, and it was often one of my parents' main concerns or questions when they were coming in, I recently went to an amazing course called the SOS Feeding Course. It was out in Atlanta, and the SOS Feeding Program is basically a sequential oral sensory program to desensitize any picky eating behaviors related to texture and to strengthen the oral motor piece that might be missing, and to just overall to make feeding fun again. So it's a very OT-themed approach, and it's very fun. So I utilize that program on a day-to-day here.
Sounds great. Man, it's tough being a child, you know?
Yeah.
You got all these issues, you know? You got the beach overwhelms you, the Chuck E. Cheese is too loud, they're telling you what to do in school, they're giving you food you don't like, the tags or the clothing are bothering you. It's just hard being a kid, right?
It is, and it's an overwhelming world.
Yeah, so you guys help sort it out for these children. I think that's great. I think you do wonderful work. Tell us how people can get a hold of you or the website for Sensational Kids, that kind of thing.
Sure. Our website is IamASensationalKid.com. And, you know, that's the best way to kind of contact us. You can always see upcoming events. We do some speaking engagements. We've had the lovely Dr. Selznick come and speak at our facility. And then, you know, we do consults. So if you have questions regarding anything that you just want some more information about, we would just do a quick consult to see if something at Sensational Kids would meet your needs, or if, or from there, maybe we could refer to a different resource.
Well, I want to thank you for that compliment. The lovely, I haven't heard that, you know, I don't know how many, lovely doctor. Anyway, but thank you so much for being a guest tonight on the show. You've been enlightening for the world, helping us to understand the world of OT and their corner of the universe with children. And these guys do great work, so I'd encourage you to contact them. And I would also encourage you to go to thecoffeeklatch.com. That's www.thecoffeeklatch. That's K-L-A-T-C-H at the end. The Coffee Klatch. There's a ton of great interviews under my section there, and other hosts that, you know, get into other topics. So I would encourage you to go there, as well as shutdownlearner.com, so www.shutdownlearner.com. And I want to thank everybody for listening, and just take care of yourself. We'll hope to see you soon, and good night, everybody. Be well.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Take care, Jess. Bye.
Bye.